Thank you, Ajahn, for your very enlightening talk. So, like Ajahn said, if you have any questions, please use this microphone. Does anybody have any questions for Ajahn?
I think they're all enlightened already. Such a good talk.
Good evening, Marimba. I have a few questions to ask you. Just now, you did mention about on the different stage of meditation, your metta will reduce or something like that. Could you elaborate more on how, what...
Can you maybe speak into the microphone a bit more? We can't hear you.
Could you elaborate more on how we reduce the metta?
I don't quite understand your question.
Just now you did mention that during this different stage of metta meditation, like stage 1, stage 2, then if you go to the next stage, then your metta will be reduced or something. Okay. So could you elaborate more? What do you mean by reduce?
Okay. So this is how we deal with if we have a problem in the practice. Let's say we're doing metta up to the third stage and we're doing okay. Yeah, metta is quite strong and sustained and we've gone through the first three stages more or less evenly. Okay, and let's say we go to the fourth stage. We try that, and when we start out on the fourth stage, okay, we're continuing along and it feels fine. We start out and we've got that momentum behind us from previous stages. Then, as we're developing metta for that fourth person, then maybe we start to think a few thoughts about that person. Okay? Oh, yeah, I remember seeing them at the shops last week. Okay? Perfectly neutral thoughts, okay? Perfectly innocent, yeah? And then maybe we start thinking a few more thoughts about them. Yeah, which are maybe not quite so innocent, and we start to think about something wrong that they did to us. Yeah, but we've got our mindfulness with us. It's okay, you know. We can accept it. We can handle it. Okay, they did that wrong thing to us, but that's all right. We forgive them, and then you keep on going a little bit more and a little bit more, and then suddenly, boop, the mind's swept away, and you've gone into anger, and you start thinking about all the awful things they've done, or what a revolting person they are. And you can't just wait to get up from your seat and go and give them a good piece of your mind. Yeah. So this is how the mind will tend to be led astray, little bit by little bit by little bit. It seems innocuous at first. Yeah. It seems like there's no problem, and then gradually it goes away. Now, when we feel that, if we're doing the meditation, then if we have maybe one or two thoughts that are straying in the wrong direction, then the feeling of metta will tend to have like a momentum. It will tend to keep going. The feeling won't disappear straight away just because we have some thoughts, okay, and we're not with the meditation all the time, okay? The meditation will have its own momentum, its own energy. But, of course, we're not supporting that momentum anymore. So the more our thoughts tend to drift away from the meditation, then the feeling will tend to drop down. And when the mind goes along, if it just happens a little bit, then it's no problem. We just bring the mind back to the meditation, keep on going, and we'll recover. And that's okay. That's natural, of course. Our mindfulness is fluctuating all the time. That's no big deal. But if we get to a stage where it's really gone astray, and the feeling just drops down substantially, then rather than trying to build it up again from where we're at, it's much more skillful to come back to a previous stage, okay, maybe back to the first stage, and then develop metta for oneself again, okay? Develop metta for oneself until that's strong and clear and stable and steady, as strong as it was before, or even stronger, okay? Then we can gradually move back up the stages back to where we were before and give it another go, okay? And then see whether that works that time. If you find that persistently you're going to a higher stage and it's having problems, it's not working, then that obviously means that you need to spend more time developing those lower stages, okay? If that's happening every time you do it, then just say to yourself, no hurry, Yeah? Be patient. Come back to the first stage and then keep on developing that. Okay? So does that answer your question? Okay.
Any more questions?
What Achan just mentioned tonight is mainly on the metta meditation. Now, when going for some retreats, whether it's long-term or short-term retreats, certain teacher may tend to emphasize on vipassana meditation or anapanasati. Now, for one who has experience in various types of meditation, it could be okay, but what if for a beginner who has, will this confuse him, or what is Achan's advice? Thank you.
Okay, so this is a very common question which I get asked quite a lot, and especially I get asked the question in Malaysia for some reason. Maybe it's a bit more of an issue in Malaysia, but I know that there's been some schools of meditation which have been in the past have been a bit exclusivist. They tend to think, well, our way is the right way and you have to do this, yeah, and this is like the one and only way. And sometimes that's a slogan which people take from the Satipatthana Sutta, and I'm sure you all know this, have heard of the Satipatthana Sutta, and it starts out with this phrase, ekayano ayang bhikkhave maggo. This is the, and it's often translated as, this is the only way, or the one and only way. So then people who do meditation, which they claim is Satipatthana meditation, then can say, well, ours is the only way. And I don't believe any of that. The Buddha said the Eightfold Path is the only way. Yeah. So the Eightfold Path includes the wisdom side, and also includes the samadhi side, the concentration. And the Buddha always taught us to have a balance of samatha and vipassana. And these are not like two competing forms of meditation, okay? You know, it's not like we got sort of samatha in the left-hand side of the ring weighing 87 pounds and then vipassana on the right-hand corner of the ring weighing 93 pounds and they're going to come out and slug it out in the middle and see who wins the battle. That's not how it is at all. But they're a pair. They're like our right hand and our left hand. You know, we use them together. So any meditation which is really what the Buddha was teaching should be a meditation which is balanced and in harmony. Okay? So these are really the kinds of criteria that we should be using. Not the criteria of, is it samatha or is it vipassana or is it this or is it that, but the criteria of, has it got balance? Yeah? Like that phrase I was mentioning before, the Ekayana Magga, it's translated as like the one and only way. And I've done quite a lot of study on this and so on. But it's interesting that one of the Chinese versions of the Satipatthana Sutta has a comment on that, and it says that phrase means, what it means is it's the way leading to oneness. Okay, the way leading to unification of mind. That's actually a very reasonable explanation, because if you are familiar with Buddhist meditation terminology, the word one is in meditation contexts is always used to mean like one-pointedness of mind or samadhi. It's a mind which is gathered into a place of oneness. So this is, I think, what the meaning of that phrase in Satipatthana is. It doesn't mean the one and only way. It means the way that leads to oneness. So this is always how we should be pursuing the meditation, although we might at a certain time we might be emphasizing one part more than the other. Sometimes we might emphasize the wisdom aspect more. We're contemplating impermanence and not self. We're seeing deeply into the nature of suffering. Okay. Another time we might be emphasizing the peace aspects, the joy aspects, the heart qualities, and that's what I was trying to emphasize this evening with the metta meditation. So, but they're not exclusivists. If we do one completely, then we need to balance that with the other. If we do the other completely and exclusively, we need to balance it with the first one. So these things always come in pairs, in harmony. Okay? So as you know, the Buddha taught, very often he taught many different kinds of meditation. And there's one group of meditations that the Buddha taught, which I always think is very good and very balanced. And these are like core meditations in Buddhism. And these are four. Okay, so I think it's good for all meditators to do these for at least a little bit. So these are, first one is loving kindness, we've done tonight, so we do that for getting rid of ill will. Second one we do is body contemplation. Okay, so this is like awareness. For example, you can imagine your skeleton. Have you ever done that kind of meditation before? You can sit like and like visualize your skeleton or your body parts. Yeah, so that's quite a fun meditation as well. And you're just kind of getting into actually what your body is like, because we live inside our body most of the time, but we actually spend outside of it. We're not really aware of what's going on in here. So this is why we do this body contemplation. Then the third one is mindfulness of breathing, anapanasati, and that especially is for getting rid of distracting thoughts, okay, for making the mind quiet. And the last one is, of course, vipassana, a contemplation of impermanence, and we do that for eradicating the idea of a self, okay? So these four meditations, I always think, is a very balanced approach to meditation. So I think it's good for all meditators to do them, but some people might emphasize one or the other to a greater degree.
Any other questions? Just one more.
Bhante, we always stress that dana, sila, bhavana. But at this present day, because of the stress in the modern living, we tend to have people wanting shortcut. They go straight into bhavana. Perhaps Bhante would like to highlight to us what is the importance of doing sila first, then bhavana if they can't do dana.
Well, this is one of the very beautiful things about the Buddhist path. Like one of the words for, we're very used to the word dana, we use for generosity, but actually there's another word they also use in Pali, which is chaga, which has the same meaning as dana. And chaga just means giving and generosity. But chaga is also found in the definition of the third noble truth, which is nibbana. Nibbana is also chaga, a giving up. And complete giving up. So it's this same word that we can use to describe the very, very simple practices, very, very simple things, like before I sat down here, then somebody got a glass of water and put the glass of water here. This is an act of chaga. And even though it's very, very simple, an act of giving, but has that same quality as the quality of nibbana. Yeah? Nibbana is not something different from that act of generosity. It is just that act taken to its completion, to its fulfillment. So the start of the Buddhist, the start of the path reflects the goal of the path. The path is like a whole. So we can't be taking bits and pieces out of it and expecting that it's going to work somehow. Okay? We have to take the whole thing and use it to... The path should imbue our whole lives so that we practice dana. We practice like specific acts of giving where we might think, well, we make a donation to the local temple or make a gift to the monks or the nuns or something like that. And this is a specific act of dana, but also just to have that attitude of dana in our lives, that attitude of giving, that attitude of always sharing what you have and helping others. When you meet somebody coming from a place of wanting to help them rather than coming from a place of defensiveness and wanting to protect oneself or to compete with somebody else. This is all part of that practice of dana. And of course, keeping precepts also is part of the same thing. When we're keeping our precepts, we're giving up. Yeah, we're giving up at a deeper level. We're giving up those aspects of cruelty, harming others. Dishonesty, theft, all of those things that are left out of our lives because of keeping the five precepts. So it's like this whole kind of burden that we're putting down. We're throwing out this whole pile of rubbish that we just don't have to carry with us in our lives anymore. And that gives us this wonderful sense of lightness in the mind. And this is why then when we come to meditate, we already feel happy. We feel contentment in the mind, and it's easy to meditate because we've got that lightness. It's terrible if you've got a problem with your sila. My goodness, you try to sit meditation, it's just burning. It's just impossible to meditate. And you can't solve those problems. Like, you can't solve problems with your sila on your meditation cushion. Okay? So don't think you can do an extra hour of meditation. Yeah? It's all right, you know, if you can commit adultery. Yeah? And then go and sit, do an extra hour's meditation and make up for it. Yeah? It doesn't work, you know, when you do those things. You know how it burns. Yeah? You know how much guilt there is. You know how much worry there is. And if you start lying and telling untruths, you know how you get in this kind of web of deceit and this web of mistrust. You always, when you're talking to people, you don't want them to find out your lies. You're always having to make more lies to protect yourself from building up this false world. So those problems have to be solved at that place. They have to be solved at the place where they arise. With your bodily acts of body and speech. And then when you come to meditate, meditation will go quite nicely. It will go easily, or at least it will go more easily. And so all this path always has to be taken as a whole. Don't be in a rush and don't think, well, I'm going to miss out on those things and sort of race along straight to the ultimate truth. You know, as a monk, I've been a monk for not very long, only for 10 years, but you know, even in that short time, I've seen many people coming and going, and you know, you tend to see that people will come along, and they'll be very diligent, throw themselves into meditation, really go for it. I heard of one monk who's an American monk. Now, this is the most I've ever heard anyone meditating, the most diligent meditator. He would sit each day three times. Okay, sit meditation three times. So you can do that, can't you? Yeah, but he would do it three times. Each time he would sit for 6 hours. Yeah. Now you think about it. Doesn't leave a lot left over, all right? So all his eating and going to the toilet and sleeping and everything else was in the rest of the remaining 6 hours. And so he was really going for it, and he did that. And then what happened at the end? Disrobed and went back home. Yeah? And so I've seen that happen. Well, I haven't seen people doing quite that much, but I've heard other stories of people meditating almost that diligently. And it was like sitting around with the monks and we're kind of talking about that. Maybe we see somebody show up at the monastery and some people come and they're really gung-ho and they want to go for it. And we're always kind of saying, oh yeah, okay, you know, that's fine. We don't want to discourage them, you know. We don't want to say, don't do that, because it's good. What they're doing is good. But it's just that attitude which is a bit over the top. And so, you know, with amongst the monks, and we're kind of talking about it, you know, we all know that, and all the monks agree on that. We were sitting and talking, oh yeah, so-and-so is going a bit extreme there. And we know that it's not going to last. And our hope is just that they don't burn themselves out in the meantime. So we try to kind of support them in the practice. But that's something that's, you know, amongst the meditation teachers, is quite well known and well accepted. We're not impressed when we see people with that kind of attitude coming into the monastery and just sort of going with that unbalanced sense. But when we see people who have that all-rounded sense of practice, that's when we're impressed. When we see somebody who's very generous, who's keeping good precepts, who's very helpful, very kind, who's also has that sense of understanding and wisdom, who likes to practice, likes to study, to understand the Buddha's teachings, to ask questions, and then also likes to apply themselves to do many hours of meditation. When we see someone like that, then we're impressed. Okay, then we think, oh, okay, they're really doing the right thing. Because they have that balanced approach. Yeah.
Okay, any questions? Alright, I think that ends tonight's talk. So let's say sadhu three times to Ajahn. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.